The words we live by. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the 10th in this series of 15 literary dialogues on love, human and divine, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Professor Mark Van Doren.
Maurice, the time has come, and I, for one, have been looking forward to it. The time has come to discuss that person of the Bible about whom more love stories are told, I think, than about any other, namely King David, who was a lover of God, first and last, and such a profound and pure lover of God that God always returned that love without question, even though there were sins to be forgiven and all that. He not only loved God, however, he loved women and his sons. He had several wives, each one of whom is the center of a love story of the greatest and deepest interest. And then, of course, there is that archetypal father and son love, which he had for Absalom. Not to speak, incidentally, of a story that we may manage to mention, too, the story of another son, Amnon, who had the tragic experience with his half-sister, Tamar. Do you agree that David is the prime lover of this book?
Well, he's not only that, Mark. There's something about him that makes me think of phrase that we used of Leonardo da Vinci, the Uomo Universale. He's the most universal man in the Bible. He was, as you said, many things. He was fighter, friend, lover, singer, a man of God, an altogether tempestuous character. And in each of these capacities, he was archetypal and outstanding, unique. I've remarked somewhere, I wrote about it, that whereas we often think of certain couples in literature and legend, Paolo and Francesca, Damon and Phidias, Tristan and Isolde, and then you're through with them. They have no other relationship. We have in David, David and Goliath. That's a universal cliché. David and Bathsheba is also a universal phrase. David and Jonathan, a universal phrase. Now, here's a man who could present himself in a duality several times, whereas others were exhausted by a single linking with somebody else.
Yes, last week we talked about David's love of Jonathan and David's love of Saul. Yes, I could have made the list much longer than I did.
And when you examine his relationship to his wives, you said that every one of them stands out. Well, actually, the record says that he had something like 16 wives, which is quite a large number. It isn't as large a number as Solomon's, who was reputed to have had 1,000.
Yeah.
But it probably means that Solomon was not the great lover that we often think of, in spite of the Song of Songs that's credited to him and which makes him the lover. That was a sort of a lyrical experience, and you think of it as having occurred just once in Solomon's life. Later on, we read that Solomon loved many strange or foreign women, but it isn't like the loves of David, each one of which is solid and is a bedrock experience around each of which a book can be written.
Yes, now, for instance, in the case of Solomon, there is not any woman whose name is connected with his, unless, to be sure, the queen. Sheba's name is connected with his, but that isn't a love story.
I wonder what one would call that, since you've mentioned it. It's a sort of a minuet,
yes.
An intellectual minuet. She comes to find out how wise he is, and he shows off to her. Unfortunately,
also comes to find out how rich he is.
Yes, I wonder what she had in mind. None of the great, wonderful riddles that he's supposed to have solved are mentioned. It's just an oriental bit of pageantry thrust in. And it illustrates, really, the difference between the passions of the two men. In Solomon's case, it was decorative more than fundamental. And in David's case, it goes down deep. You feel the blood boiling in every one of these incidents of his life.
Yes. Another way of saying that might be this, that David is always personal in his love. His love is for a person who, for the time being, is everything to him. Because each one of his wives seems to have been that. And maybe several of them were concurrently. But when David loved, he gave all of his love to the person in question. Whether it was Saul, who seemed to hate him and didn't. Whether it was Jonathan, to whom he was bound in that beautiful relationship of which we spoke last week. Or whether it was any of his wives, or whether it was Absalom, his love for whom... there were those at the time who said was excessive, whatever that means. An excess of love is something difficult to define, because love, I suppose, ideally cannot exist in excess. But let's consider now, if you please, at least some of these wives. The story is just of the three, Michal and Abigail and Bathsheba. Are very different.
Well,
from one
another. The one that interests me in a peculiar way is Michal, the daughter of Saul.
Yeah, that's what I should call her, I dare say. But otherwise, you confuse her with the archangel.
Yes, I think of it always by the Hebrew name.
Yeah, let's say Michal.
Michal. Well, do you think is there any evidence that he loved her? The story goes that she saw him, she fell in love with him. The indication is that she did or wanted to do great things for him. She certainly helped to save his life when Saul was after him, when she let him out of the window and then disguised, put a figure in his bed. But there's no indication that he was enchanted by her or loved her. I get the impression that she was the imperious type. She was the princess who was patronizing the shepherd boy who had made such a success at court, and she wanted to play the great role in his life, and it irked him.
Well,
I don't think there was love on his side for her, and on her part, I wouldn't call it, well, yes, love if you like, but also the kind of love that wants to direct somebody else's life.
Well, there are only two points at which one can assume love in David. We're here in the beginning that Saul gave to David his daughter Michal, and David loved her. This is that simple statement. Later on, remember, Saul, in his anger at David, for various reasons, took away this daughter and deprived David of that wife and gave her to Paltiel, the poor man about whom we know only that he took her and they lived together in his house. And then one day when David was free to do so, free of Saul, he sent for her. Now, it is true that he remembered her. She didn't just pass out of his mind like something discarded. He wanted her again. It could be that he wanted her again only as a piece of property that Saul had deprived him of.
It may have been more than that. I don't mean emotionally. It may have been more than that in the political sense.
Yes.
He may have wanted the daughter of Saul in order to... establish his connection with the first dynasty and show the world that Saul's daughter was with him. There was a deep cleavage of temperament between them. You remember that when David brought the ark up to Jerusalem and danced before the ark with the religious abandon, how she sneered at him and said how reproached him with having shown himself off to the servant girls. And he retorted bitterly that he would show himself the worshipper of God before everybody, and he put her away. He couldn't stand that bitter sarcasm of hers.
And
she was too aristocratic.
And we are told that she, presumably as a result of this, she never had a child by him. That is to say, she ceased effectually to be his wife from that
the
point
legends
on.
The legends tell us that... she never consummated her marriage with Paltiel. The legends say that they slept with a sword between them. I suppose it's an attempt to vindicate the purity of her relationship toward David, even though she is condemned in the legends, too, for... Well,
of course, let's not forget poor Paul Teal. When David sent his general, Abner, to bring her back from Paul Teal, Paul Teal, instead of saying, very well, it is the will of David and I must relinquish her, and instead of saying that and closing the door as she left, he followed. Followed pitifully behind them, a long, long way, even as far as Bahurim, I believe. And at that point, Abner suddenly turned about to him, to this poor man who followed without a word, just dumbly longing for Michal, and said, go, return. And the Bible simply tells us that Paltiel returned. And that's the last we hear of him.
Yes.
Just
well,
one little name
I
thrown up
many
on...
years ago, we discussed this, and you thought I was rather harsh on Paltiel for being, they call that in Yiddish, being a schmutter, being just a rag.
Mm.
He should have had the manhood to give her up when he had to. Not to go, as I conceive it, sniveling along as, ah, oh, please don't turn me down. And until the very last moment, till somebody gives him a kick and says, well, say, beat it, and he beat it. You were much more sympathetic toward him then than I was. And I'm still unsympathetic. I find him a rather paltry character. I don't know why he lingers there, except as some sort of exhibition of the little man pushing his way in among people with whom he doesn't belong.
Although...
A hanger-on of history.
Yes, although his behavior may indicate that Michal was desirable, and may indicate that somewhere or other in David's feeling for her, there was the feeling of desire and love. I don't know. But, of course, Abigail is another story altogether, isn't it? She was married to the rich farmer, Nabal. And David and Nabal had defended David's young men who were scouting the country for income for David, for revenue for him. Nabal insulted David's young men, and David decided to move against him and seize his property, and I dare say even put him to death. Well, his wife, Abigail, Nabal's wife, Abigail, hearing this, knowing that this was about to be, set out for the mountains to a point where she knew David would be coming, with asses laden down with fruit and meats and wine and so forth, and there, to be sure, David arrived in a pass of the mountains, and there she was prostrate before him. And she said, I give you all these things. And she enumerates them. It's a very lovely list of things that she offers. And she says, you must not proceed and commit this murder, which I believe you have in mind. I have come, as a matter of fact, to save you from the guilt of murder.
Well, there's a very high theme there. She tells him that he must not take the law into his own hands. She forecasts the time when he will be the king, and he mustn't have this stain on his record. There's a great nobility about that encounter. Although, to be sure, there is behind it also the shimmer of a romantic relationship. The setting itself calls for it. Here is this lovely woman. The text calls her well-favored or handsome or beautiful and of good understanding. And here is this young warlord, still an outlaw.
Certainly very handsome himself.
We can assume. Of ruddy countenance, we're told.
Yes.
That was a rarity among the Israelites of that time. Fair to look upon, and here they meet, and these soldiers of fortune, as they were, surrounding him, and she comes to tell him to relinquish the notion of taking revenge on Nabal and of... wiping out the... He had, in fact, definitely said he wouldn't leave a single male alive in that place. He was in such a fury of resentment against Nabal. And here comes this handsome, intelligent woman, and they stand face to face. And actually, in the legends, there is a hint of the fact that David was very deeply stirred by her.
Well...
And she was aware of it, and touch of prophetic foresight, she saw... in the far-off time, a day when David would kill for the sake of love. And she was the restraining hand. Altogether, it's a very exalted picture.
Yes, I'm sure that as she was beautiful to him, so he was beautiful to her. And when David accedes, And to her request that he desist, and turns about and says, very well, you have saved me from blood guilt, and I return. She returns also to her husband's farm, but tells her husband, who is at that moment drunk, very drunk, tells her husband all that happened and the danger that he'd been in, the danger that she'd saved him from, and is so eloquent about it, I don't think I'm overstating the case, so eloquent about it that the fear, ex post facto fear, kills him. He falls backwards and dies. Or within 10 days he dies.
Yes,
he has a fit. He has a
That was the end of it. It occurs to me, among the other features of David's capacities, he was a great hater, too. He could love tremendously, and he could hate tremendously. I'm always impressed in a very depressing way by the fact that on his deathbed, he remembered Shimi ben Gera. You remember the old man, right, when David was fleeing from Absalom? Shimi ben Gera watched him leaving the city and cursed him, thou man of blood, he called him, which was not an unjust appellation. David had been a killer. And afterwards, Shimi ben Gera was forgiven in a way by David, who said that he wouldn't take his life from him. And on his deathbed, that thing rankled so that in a most unworthy way, he told his son Solomon, don't let his hoary head go down to the grave in peace. Punish him for me. Solomon didn't exactly punish him the way David had instructed him. He told Shimi ben Gera to stay in Jerusalem, put him under house arrest. Said, if you leave this house, then you'll be put to death. And for some reason, it may have been a pretext. Some servants had run away from Shimei, and he set out in pursuit of them. I say it may have been a pretext, and then he was put to death. But this capacity that as he lay dying, there boiled up in David, an old man of whom we know that the warmth had gone out of him, and he was all passion spent, one would think, with that tremendous and multicolored life of his, he couldn't resist the recalling of that rage. There was hatred, the capacity for hatred in him as well as for love, but the love overwhelmed the hatred.
Yes, now in the case of Abigail, David, who never forgot anything, remembers Abigail upon his return home, because it isn't very long before, doubtless knowing of her husband's death, he sends for her to come to him and be one of his and be his wife. I'm interested in the fact that the Bible represents her as obeying with complete alacrity. She has been thinking of him too. I'm sure if the phrase means anything, she fell in love with him in the mountains that day too, and so instantly she gathers all of her things together and goes off.
Well, there was something
that is all we
that
hear
they, that the rabbis have commented on with disapproval. That at the very moment when she brings this message to David that he's not to proceed and not to stain his record with this murder or the killing of Nabal and his men, she tells him that when you come into your own, meaning when you become the king of Israel, don't forget me. And the rabbis make an adverse comment on it. There was something in her mind which was unbecoming, and it detracts from the loftiness of the approach which she made to him.
Well, I hadn't thought of that. And then, of course, there's Bathsheba, whose story is the most complicated of them all, since it involves murder by David of her husband, since it involves a sight of her as she was bathing on a roof next to his palace, since it involves that complete experience of love at first sight of Bathsheba, and the feeling that he must have her at all costs, even though that one of those costs will be the life of Uriah, her husband, whom he puts in the front rank of the troops.
Well, he didn't so intend it. I'm afraid it's even more discreditable than that in a way. In a way, I say. Because he would have been glad to have Uriah think that the child was his. You remember that when Uriah came back from the battle, David urged him insistently to go and visit his home, and Uriah very nobly refused, saying, when the army is encamped before Rabbath Ammon and
Israel is intense. Shall I go home and be comfortable with my wife? Make love to her? It was only then. There was a touch of the intrigante there that is very painful for me to consider and isn't often commented on by the rabbi, because, of course, they were overwhelmed by the crime, the dark crime, the blood guilt that rested on David. What is interesting to me about the love story of David and Bathsheba is that here is a love which begins illicitly. It is one of the most outstanding illicit love episodes in the Bible, and it was redeemed. It was redeemed by the fact that David was punished, was denounced by the prophet Nathan, sincerely repented, and then the love between them became sanctified to the extent that of Bathsheba was to be born the, in one sense, in certain directions, the most illustrious king of ancient Israel, Solomon. So that you place here in a sort of contrast a sin, repentance, punishment, and redemption.
And of course, by the way, there is the punishment, the very acute punishment, which consisted of the death of the child by their first adultery. You remember?
Yes.
That child was not allowed to live. Solomon came later. Solomon was the result of their true union.
And God had a special relation to Solomon. Solomon also had the name of Yedidiah, the friend of God. Sometimes I think that the outstanding episode in that relationship, the one which on which the redemption hinges, is the fashion in which David took the rebuke from Nathan. Now, here we're speaking of an absolute monarch. There were no formal or legal restrictions on David's power. He could do whatever he liked. And the court prophet, it wasn't a prophet that came from the outside, but one who was an intimate of the king, came before him, and in one of the most powerful denunciations that has ever been penned, it's one of the most powerful things in the Bible, and that already places it in a class by itself, told him this story of the rich man to whom the visitor came and who wouldn't take one from his own flock, a sheep from his own flock, but took the ewe lamb of the poor man and got David into a rage against that man. He said, "That man deserveth to die." And Nathan points the finger of accusation at him, "Thou art the man."
Yeah.
But David didn't strike him down, didn't fly into one of his characteristic rages, that instead he cowered away from him, acknowledged that he had sinned, and listened to all the denunciation which poured from the lips of Nathan, that the kingdom wouldn't last, and that the things that he had done in secret would be done to him in the open, that he had taken someone's wife in secret, but that his wives would be taken openly and in the light of the sun. All of this poured out, and David didn't strike back.
Yes.
Now, when one thinks of his explosive nature, and, for instance, the way he went up to kill Nabal and to wipe out the whole of that settlement, one thinks of him as the great warrior.
Well,
stood there and took it.
Well, stood there and listened. I would like to say listened. He stood there and listened to Abigail on that occasion. After all, he was a man, among other things, of intellect. And the clearest sign of the presence of intellect in anyone is his power to listen, to receive into his mind something that wasn't there before. You know, the person who can't listen to anything, who can't hear anything, and can't take in any new thing, is in all people's minds, I think, the very symbol of stupidity. David could listen to Abigail. He had listened to Saul, for that matter. He listens now to Nathan the prophet. And let's remember, too, how he listened to Joab when Joab reproved him for his overlong, in Joab's mind, his overlong lamentation over Absalom. At that point, David, feeling as he did, could have risen and had Joab removed, as a matter of fact. In a sense, he never did forgive him for that. But You have the image, and I think this is one of the... It's a curious thing. It isn't accented. It's a negative thing as far as words go, but I'm not sure about what's the most powerful thing we ever learn about David. There is David, after that marvelous outbreak of lamentation for Absalom, sitting in grief, his head bowed, not saying a word, not doing anything, hour after hour and hour after hour, and suddenly Joab coming to him and saying these things into his ear, which he immediately obeys. He doesn't even say, I heard you. He doesn't say yes or no.
It had ripened in him. Here is the man...
Well, but that's a sign, isn't it, of very great intelligence.
Yes. It's more than intelligence.
Yes, more than intelligence.
There is a depth in him which responds at the right moment, just before it's too late.
Yes.
He risked his soul for the sake of Bathsheba and redeemed it. He risked his kingdom for the sake of Absalom. He knew the kind of young man that Absalom was. He could see Absalom preparing this rebellion and this weakness for his son, this overweening fondness for him, made him close his eyes to what was a tremendous danger for the kingdom, because there's very little doubt that if Absalom had raised the standard of rebellion, the brothers of Absalom would have fought it, and the kingdom would have been rent into pieces long before it actually fell apart. Yet, in these movements of his soul, his capacity for love outran his discretion, outran his duty, outran his sense of justice. But in the end, he was brought round. What is so deeply moving about him is the fact that he was capable of these extremities of feeling that were actually sinful in their apparent uncontrollability, but at the last moment, before the irretrievable had been done, he was recalled, in one case by Nathan, in the other case by Joab. Or they were the instruments of that recall.
You know, it's interesting suddenly to me, Maurice, to remember how many love stories we have told here this summer that were the love stories of fathers and sons, fathers for sons. The love of a father for a son probably may always exceed the love of the son for the father, the father being older and richer in his experience. But we talked, you remember, about Abraham and Isaac.
Yes.
Now, David and Absalom. But before, and there was Jacob and Joseph. I'm not sure, but what those are the true archetypal love stories
it
of the Bible.
It may be. In any case, we've talked mostly, except in the case of Dinah, of the loves that were ennobled or fruitful. Next week, I'd like to talk with you about the what I've called the disastrous love episodes of the Bible.
Just heard The Words We Live By, the 10th in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Professor Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of love, human and divine. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
Next, monitor news on the hour on NBC Radio.